On November the 3rd, the non-profit World Preservation Foundation co-hosted with Dodds Parliamentary Services a unique gathering at the historic Central Hall, Westminster in London, with speakers from government, science, media and advocacy organisations to discuss the increasingly evident effects of climate change and explain how the production of food, and in particular livestock raising, is seriously impacting global warming, biodiversity loss, water shortages and more. Leaders Preserving Our Future, Pace and Priorities on Climate Change was attended by experts and dignitaries such as the Duchess of Norfolk, High Commissioner for Antigua and Barbuda, Dr. Carl Roberts, Dr. Esther van der Voort, a representative from the United Nations Environment Programme, and the ambassadors of such countries as Russia, Bolivia, Nepal, and others. The highlight of the afternoon was the presence of Supreme Master Ching Hai, who delivered a message via video on solving the large environmental crisis of concern in the meeting, as well as urging leaders and co-citizens alike to make courageous, earth-saving changes. We now invite you to join us for part one of the 7-part rebroadcast of the live conference, Leaders Preserving Our Future, Pace and Priorities on Climate Change, on November the 3rd, 2010, in Westminster, London, in the United Kingdom.
So, just to welcome you all to today's conference, Leaders Preserving Our Future, Pace and Priorities on Climate Change, which is jointly organised by Dodds and the World Preservation Foundation. And we really are delighted to have you here, particularly in the circumstance. This conference has been organised with a very specific aim in mind. It's to raise awareness about the urgency of having a near-term solution for climate change and to highlight one of the most effective solutions to achieve this. As you will notice, we've got a lot of speakers today, many of them sitting next to me even as I speak, and they're from different scientific fields and very many prestigious organisations. So I'm going to start by introducing our first speaker, who is Jeff Tansey. Jeff is a trustee of the Food Ethics Council in the United Kingdom and one of the 6 recipients of the Joseph Rowntree Visionaries Award. He's also winner of the Derek Cooper Award for Best Food Campaigner and Educator, and today he'll address the conference on how we can ensure food security from global to local level in the face of water scarcity and climate change. So if you'd put your hands together, please, for our first speaker, Mr. Tansey.
Right, thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks to the Foundation for the invitation to speak here. The Food Ethics Council is an independent charity that seeks to put ethical thinking at the heart of our discussions on food. And that means looking at social justice and fairer decisions within the framework of the bigger picture. I'm speaking here personally, but drawing on some of the work of the Council. But first, let's look at today's world. We have a dysfunctional food system, despite having the capacity to feed everyone well. It leaves getting on for 1 billion people hungry, well over that, overweight or obese, and even more with micronutrient deficiencies. The poor are affected most. Most people still work in agriculture globally. Most poor people are still in the rural areas, and women are often the most badly affected. Yet they're also responsible for the majority of food produced and hold much knowledge about farming in challenging and difficult environments around the world. Now, achieving food security for all is a complex challenge, and it's got many ingredients and there are lots of definitions. After the first world food crisis in the 1970s, the focus was on grain reserves, as this quote illustrates. Now, this broader definition from the FAO summit in 1996 is usually linked to thinking about food security in terms of 3 words: accessibility, availability, and affordability. But it actually neglects how food is produced and distributed and the sustainability of that. Some more recent thinking looks at sustainable food systems where you're very clear about what the goals are. It includes the 3 A's, but embeds them in systems that are sustainable and resilient. Increasingly, however, peasants' movements seek food sovereignty, which adds who has what power and control in the system into the equation. Now, achieving food security requires action from the global to the household level. It also means that no one suffers fear and anxiety about where and when the next meal will come from, and is confident of that continuing. And that's a confidence that climate change could shatter for all of us. The long-term worst-case scenarios see farming becoming impossible in many tropical latitudes, failing monsoons in India, loss of the Amazon rainforest, widespread desertification in Africa and elsewhere, leading to population movements the like of which we have never seen. The best single way of dealing with these is not to go there, to change our practices now before it's too late. The least bad scenarios suggest major disruptions in key producing areas, yield declines in many areas in the tropics and surrounding temperate areas, with perhaps some advantage to the higher latitudes. All see a loss of biodiversity and agricultural biodiversity. Now, these trends are often talked about in terms of 2 to 6 degree average rise in temperature, but this really is misleading. For climate change will, indeed is already, destabilising weather patterns, leading to more and more extreme events of increasing intensity, from floods, as we saw recently in Pakistan and Thailand, which will be exacerbated for coastal areas, and we're in one, looking at the Thames, as sea levels rise with melting ice caps and glaciers, to winds and droughts and fires, as we saw in Russia recently. Now, these extremes will make harvests less predictable. If several coincide in one year, they may lead to major food shortages of core commodities and huge price rises. Price fluctuations and rises will indeed already have been compounded by competition over scarce resources, using land for agrofuels and commodity price speculation, as we saw particularly in 2007 and 8, when over 100 million people were driven into hunger and governments fell. Now, although the poor and most marginalised are the first to suffer from climate change, it will affect everyone, including us here, and push food prices up and disrupt supply chains. Now, we need to meet these challenges in ways that embed social justice into the heart of our approach. Otherwise, it will fail. As our inquiry into food and fairness discussed in a recent report, Food Justice, this means addressing the issues about fair shares, fair say, and fair play in tackling the problems in the food system and climate change. But it also is about recognising what can be done within a food system framework and what requires changes to the rules of the game. Now, as Tim Jackson said in his eloquent evidence to the Commission, the rich really need to rethink what we mean by prosperity and develop a new kind of ecological economics that's not based on the growth paradigm, what he calls prosperity without growth. For us in Britain and Europe, that means questioning assumptions, such as that we can eat what we want, when we want, from wherever we want. It means accepting responsibility for the generation of greenhouse gas emissions, as well as the extent of our ecological debt, as our footprint spreads much more widely over the world than our numbers justify, thanks in significant part to our need for animal feed. So it requires innovation, but not just in technology, where so much of the focus goes. And even there, the focus is often on finding ways that are essentially about allowing us to carry on doing what we do now, such as agrofuels, rather than change. And in reality, we need innovation that allows us to do things differently, not just technologically, but socially, politically, and economically. We need to rethink the way we produce food, to move from intensive systems which are fossil fuel based to farming systems that are more agroecologically sound and resilient, as has been argued in various reports over the last few years, the global report at the top, the one from the National Academy of Sciences in the States. But we do also need to rethink what we consume. Whether or not we can feed a world with a population likely to stabilise at 9.5 billion people depends upon what they all eat and the impact of producing that food on our life support systems. Now, it wouldn't be sustainable nor healthy, for example, for global meat and dairy consumption levels to rise to that of the American or European level. Food accounts for about 20% of total UK greenhouse gas emissions by consumption, and that rises to 30% if you include indirect emissions from global land use changes. Meat and dairy is about 7 to 8%. Agriculture globally also uses about 70% of the water that's abstracted, and the UK imports about two-thirds of the virtual water it uses in food. And the way we do things at the moment increases the loss of biodiversity and agricultural biodiversity. So, apart from action to change on production, we also need action on waste and consumption. To reduce the waste built into systems through the standards and production processes and supply chains, to the waste that occurs domestically and in catering. Now, the Food Ethics Council, along with WWF, has been looking at consumption of meat and dairy, because this is a significant part of our greenhouse gases in the UK, and you'll hear more from WWF this afternoon. And our latest report is actually out on Friday. Now, the work focused on consumption-related emissions because a production focus ignores the emissions that arise when production is done abroad, so-called offshoring. Now, one essential in this is dialogue with the producers, so that they are able to engage with and see the calls for eating less meat, for example, as an opportunity in developing a more equitable, resilient and sustainable food system. The producers can also give the practical insights of the perhaps unintended consequences of different policies. So I think we need to see this as a time of opportunity as well as danger, if we are to avoid in the future the sense of deja vu I get today when I look back at the world food crisis in the 70s. As this quote illustrates, when I first started working on food policy. We actually need creative solutions from the bottom up, with an enabling frameworks that do not disadvantage the poor. Now, food is a lens through which to look at the problems we face. It connects peoples, and it's an opportunity because it's something that everyone needs. And it's a way of helping people understand both the importance of dealing with climate change and the things that can be done about it. And the way we deal with food links sustainability, health of people and planet, and social justice, and that includes gender equality. And I look forward to hearing more detail about the other areas as we go throughout the day. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. Our next speaker is David Vaughan. Professor David Vaughan is a climate scientist at the British Antarctic Survey and was coordinating lead author of the IPCC Fourth Assessment Report, and he's just about to begin the same role in the Fifth Assessment. His research focuses on the role of ice sheets, the threat of climate change and rising sea levels. Professor Vaughan will now speak about ice melt in Antarctica in terms of its effect, severity, urgency and potential consequences. Please put your hands together.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I speak today as a working scientist rather than a representative of the IPCC, but I do have those roles that were pointed out. Sea level rise is somewhat the poster child of climate change, partly because people can really understand quite simply what the impacts are. That's actually an illusion. Some of the impacts are quite subtle and difficult to understand, and we're going to talk about some of those in this talk. Sea level rise has two aspects that speak to the climate change debate. One is the longevity of the response that's provoked by climate change that might go on for many, many centuries after carbon emissions have stabilised. And the other is that there is really no going back, that once sea level rise begins, then it is here to stay for a considerable period. And the only rational response in the short term, let's say less than 200 years, is adaptation. Climate change is being provoked by increasing carbon dioxide and methane, greenhouse gases. I think there's very little doubt about that. And throughout geological history, as temperature has risen, carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases are risen, so has sea level. The question is really what's going to happen in the future. And there are several different sources of sea level rise within the Earth system. One is the straightforward expansion of the oceans as the temperatures rise. Actually, this takes many decades, perhaps even longer than that, before the heat really gets into the deeper parts of the ocean and the full effects of ocean expansion are seen. Then we have the loss of mountain glaciers around the world, and throughout the world, mountain glaciers are now being lost in virtually every glaciated mountain range. This is just one example. I showed it to somebody the other day while I was trying to put this together, and they said, "That's a lot of ice." And indeed it is. This is just one glacier. Elsewhere, there are, in the polar regions, two large ice sheets, one in Greenland and one in Antarctica. Each has the capacity, the ice in it, to raise global sea level by many metres. And we are now seeing some losses in those areas. The key issue here is that once loss from these ice sheets is provoked, once it's driven, then it may continue for many, many centuries. Sea level is currently rising and has been increasing in the rate that it's rising throughout the 20th century. We are now at 3 millimetres a year. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a one-way street. It's very hard to imagine that the losses of ice that contribute primarily to this are actually going to decrease in the near future. So 3 millimetres a year adds up to 3 centimetres per decade, and by the time we're at a century, it's starting to look like a substantial amount. The IPCC's last projections of sea level rise were something between 19 centimetres and 58 centimetres by the end of 2100. However, some of the effects that the authors of that report were very suspicious were going to start showing were not included in that projection. And they took a somewhat brave, in my opinion, view of saying that really isn't the science to include all of these effects, specifically the ice sheet's response to changing atmospheric and ocean temperatures, into those projections. So those projections were, in a sense, lacking in one of the key elements. Since that last IPCC report has gone on, we have developed substantial numbers of 4 separate ways of measuring the ice loss from these 2 major ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland. And you can see that there are some large areas where ice loss is now persistent year to year and is sufficient that it's making a significant contribution to that 3 millimetres a year of global sea rise. Elsewhere around the Antarctic Peninsula, we've seen the loss of many ice shelves. This one in the background, Wilkins Ice Shelf, was the most recent one to really hit the headlines. But actually, the headline news is not the one that I want you to take away. The smaller diagram to the right-hand side shows that this pattern has been persistent all the way along the Antarctic Peninsula, where ice shelves have been retreating over a considerable period, at least the last 50 years. Those are the projections from the IPCC. However, if we start to think about what those projections might look like if we really do include realistic contributions from ice sheets, then perhaps we can think of, you know, certainly the left-hand diagram shows quite a moderate scenario that continues the rate of sea level rise over the last 150 years, shown in the green line, in a relatively simple progression and reaches 0.5 metre by 2100. And a more aggressive increase in the rate of ice loss from Antarctica and Greenland would push us up to something like the right-hand side diagram, where we have about 1.4 metres by 2100. Now, these are still well short of the real doomsday scenarios that some commentators, even some scientists, have been talking about. And I actually think that that right-hand side does represent something close to an upper limit on the likely sea level rise by 2100. However, by the time we get to 2100 in that scenario, we're seeing sea level rise at a rate of about 10 times its current rate. What does this really mean? It's very hard to understand really what, let's say, a metre of sea level rise actually means. Well, let's focus on London because we're here, and you know, along with 1.25 million other people and an enormous amount of property and assets close to sea level. In the UK, we've been very responsive to flooding events in the past and have raised our sea defences largely when a flooding event has actually driven us to do it. You can see this seawall down near Greenwich and how it was raised, most notably after floods in 1928, and then again as the Thames Barrier was being built after the 1953 flood. We've tended to be extremely responsive in the way that we look at sea defence and build to it. In the future, we need to be much more proactive. The building of the Thames Barrier and its potential replacement in the next few decades is actually a bit of a triumph, and actually what I need to preface what I'm going to say next is that the Environment Agency actually has a very sensible and forward-looking plan to protect London in the future. And what's it trying to protect against? Well, if we look at the storm statistics gathered over the last 100 years or so, then we can project what we believe is likely to be the 1-in-1,000-year storm, height, something over 6.5 metres, the 1-in-100-year storm height, and the 1-in-10-year storm height. Now, you can see that if we raised global sea level by 50 centimetres, remember that's actually a fairly moderate range, we shift this axis along the bottom so that the 1-in-100-year storm surge is now equivalent to what was the 1-in-1,000-year storm surges. Another 50 centimetres of sea level rise, and that 1-in-1,000-year storm surge, when the Thames Barrier was built, will now start to come every 10 years. So we would really, under that scenario, have to consider a substantial raising of Thames protection, sea defences. Looking more globally, we have enormous sea level populations now living close to coasts and in vulnerable areas, and already about 10 million people a year are affected by coastal flooding. That might go up naturally without sea level rise to something like 30 million a year by mid-century. If we have a substantial sea level rise on top of that, then we could easily double that. This is enormous numbers of people suffering from coastal flooding every year. Obviously, in developing countries, there are significant issues associated with survival of coastal populations. And we tend to think of the developing countries as uniquely vulnerable to this. In many ways, our developed cities and developing countries have actually developed to the state that they've lost their adaptability. And this is a picture of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. I'm not saying that global change caused Hurricane Katrina or even indeed the flooding here. However, it's fairly clear that with sea level rise in the future, more events like this are likely to occur and with a greater frequency. So what's the role for science now? Well, I think we have got past the point where scientists really should be issuing warnings of drastic climate change and really looking to our role of what we can do to help society come to terms with this. And indeed, in sea level rise science, I think we have a great role in improving the quantification of risk, improving the basis for sea defence planning on that relatively short time scale of, let's say, 100 to 200 years, support for coastal adaptation, where defence is not the only answer, and the avoidance of unwarranted expenditure or expenditure that is too soon. Good predictions allow you to time the expenditure of sea defence infrastructure much more effectively. And finally, we have a role in contributing towards a fuller evaluation of the long-term impact of climate change on the planet and the commitment to long-term sea level rise that will continue even after carbon dioxide emissions have stabilised. European Union is funding at the moment a substantial programme with 24 institutes across Europe to contribute towards sea level rise projection, and this is my project that I'm leading at the moment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Our next speaker is John Topping, the founder and president of the Climate Institute in Washington, D.C., served as editor for portions of the IPCC First Assessment Report and was recognized for his contribution in the 2007 award of the Nobel Peace Prize to the IPCC. Mr. Topping will talk about recent research highlighting the importance of reducing non-CO2 shorter-lived climate forces and how they can significantly reduce the cause of warming in the near future. Please put your hands together for John Topping.
Thank you very much. Dr. Vaughan's presentation, I think, underscored the urgency of acting, and what I'm going to do here is pick up on something where I want to compliment the World Preservation Foundation and Dodds for their prescience, really, in a couple of regards. One of focusing very much on the role of agriculture and food systems, really, in the whole climate issue. This has really tended to be underplayed very much in most of the discussions. And also on recognizing the importance of moving on shorter-lived greenhouse gases, things other than carbon dioxide. Not that we don't want to move on carbon dioxide, but if we wait and we focus only on carbon dioxide, all the worst things that were projected by Dr. Vaughan, the high end, would probably happen. And it's one of the reasons why Micronesia, one of the very vulnerable island countries, has really been very active in the UN in pushing for action on black carbon. I'm grateful to Dr. Michael McCracken, our chief scientist, who also ran the U.S. National Assessment and for 4 years headed the International Association of Meteorology and Atmospheric Sciences, and my colleague, John Michael Cross, for developing some fairly interesting graphics to illustrate the opportunities and the need to act. First, you'll see using the business as usual scenario. BAU essentially is what happens if you don't have climate conscious policies, but you assume a certain amount of natural energy efficiency that would happen with the development of the world economy. As you can see, there are legacy greenhouse emissions, primarily CO2 from the past century. Some would be longer-lived greenhouse gases like nitrous oxide, some chlorofluorocarbons, which still persist, even though we've moved aggressively under the Montreal Protocol. There would be rapid increases under business as usual in CO2, but also from methane, which would be associated both with agricultural activity and energy activity, from tropospheric ozone, which is essentially a product of a variety of carbon monoxide, methane, hydrocarbons in the presence of NOx, essentially creating something that is dangerous both to human health and to agricultural crops. That's what we tend to think of as smog in urban areas and so on. And then some other greenhouse gases, nitrous oxide and a variety of others here. Black carbon is something that really was ignored largely in the climate debate until the last couple of years. It's probably where we can make the biggest difference in the near term. I mean, this is essentially soot in particles that are a great danger to human health. Because they're only up for a week or two at a time, the tendency was to not factor them in. But the problem is they're constantly replenished. If cook stoves don't change, if the urban transportation doesn't change, if the industrial practices don't change, those particles are replenished readily. And on the other hand, if they do change, you can make a huge difference in radiative forcing very quickly, while also having very positive impacts on human health. There's also a huge inertia within the energy systems and also, to some extent, within the agricultural systems of the world. In the U.S., interestingly, in the last couple of years, there's been a dramatic drop in CO2 levels from 2007 to 2009, about a 10% per capita drop, half of that due to changes in the world economy, other things really due to switching of from coal to natural gas, because we have a lot of available natural gas, and a variety of other things that are structural change. We have a couple of practical problems with the greenhouse system right now, the trading systems formally. In the formal system, 1 ton of methane is equated to 22 tons of CO2. But the practical problem is if if we're concerned with the very dangerous things that could be happening soon, we probably ought to have a much higher valuation for methane. I mean, you know, many of these tipping points are really likely to happen in the lifetime of many of us in this room, not, you know, in 2100. I'll give you a quick illustration here. I mean, the 1 to 22 is really looking at this over a 100-year period. But if we really look at the equation over a 20-year period, methane could have a much higher valuation. You know, the reason for that is typically you're talking about a 12-year residence in the atmosphere versus in a much longer term than carbon dioxide. So in terms of what's driving the changes that would be melting the Greenland ice sheet, that would be causing the positive feedbacks, the metastatic climate change that may be going on in the Arctic, changed albedo, other things that are feeding on itself, this itself is a problem. What's interesting is while carbon dioxide is the most important single constituent driving climate change, it's responsible for less than half. And because it's so persistent in the atmosphere, you aren't going to make a huge dent right away. Even if we could wave a magic wand, we would find carbon dioxide concentrations and stop all emissions. Would still stay awfully flat, and the radiative forcing would still be very, very large. This underscores the need to work in some other areas. Now, the fortunate thing about this is most of the other short-term climate forcers are ones where there are huge human health benefits or other win-win aspects. Methane levels have been rising last 12 years in the atmosphere. It has roughly half the effect of CO2. But there are a remarkable number of win-win aspects when we talk about reducing methane. Coal miners' safety from draining of methane that would be responsible for explosions, harvesting energy from gas pipeline leaks, from avoiding flaring, landfill methane in the agricultural area, improved animal husbandry, and moving to a more plant-based diet, which would reduce both CO2 and methane basis, and probably doing that primarily on a health basis. Now, black carbon plays a couple of important roles. It's only up for a short period of time, but it's constantly replenished. It has a warming effect that's roughly 55%, according to the better science on this, I think, is the Ramanathan Carmichael science of CO2. And that doesn't even include calculating the albedo effect, where in the Arctic it plays a much larger role, and in the Himalayas as well, they're potentially impairing water supplies. But it has huge impacts on human health, and that's perhaps the key to being able to get aggressive action on this. Now, the regional effects of this are quite large. These are indications from a few scientists here. The effects really together of black carbon and tropospheric ozone, and to some extent the reduction of the sulfates that happened because of necessary steps we took to address acid rain and so forth. These look like the primary driver for the very, very rapid warming that has been happening recently within the Arctic. And there's a real opportunity to make a difference here. Now, what are the opportunities from aggressive actions on black carbon? Perhaps the most immediate would be acute decreases in the Arctic warming, and that's probably the most dangerous single thing that can happen on the planet right now with respect to sea level and with respect to the possibility of climate feedbacks. But it also has the ability to cut down substantially the nearly 2 million lives, about 1.9 million from cook stoves, about 85% women and children, and outdoor air pollution, which kills about another 800,000 worldwide. This can go ahead aggressively, and at the same time, it yields very sizable climate benefits. What's interesting is if we assume, for example, a 50% reduction by 2050 across the board, including CO2, and an 80% reduction by the end of the century, this is how things would break out. As you can see, we can make a dent in CO2, and that's important, but we can make a huge dent and the other gases because of the times and so forth there, and especially so with respect to black carbon. Now, this takes us, you know, between now and 2040, a lifetime in which, you know, many of us, would hope to be around for much of this time. This is really the critical time, I think, for a lot of these tipping points. And the first is business as usual, and then the second is the aggressive reductions. If we do this, we really have a chance of avoiding absolutely catastrophic climate change. Right now, the two most interesting efforts underway are clean cook stove efforts. The UN Foundation and Shell Foundation and others have worked very much on this, where, you know, the primary motivation is really saving people's lives, but at the same time, there will be real benefits to the climate. In Manila, there's a fascinating effort underway right now involving an Australian firm that is retrofitting jeepneys, working with the Jeepney Owners Association, using voluntary emission reduction credits. Jeepney drivers die a lot sooner than others, and the pollution levels are very high as a result of this. Hopefully, some of these things through the voluntary emission reduction credit systems will happen. Now, at the same time we move on black carbon, it's important that industrial countries have to move aggressively on it as well. In the industrial countries, we can strengthen diesel standards, and we're starting to do that. We can also take off-road vehicles or retrofit some of the older vehicles that don't meet the standards, increase industrial energy recycling, cogeneration, which harvests both CO2 and also additional particulates, and then work aggressively through the Arctic Council on these areas. I would like to suggest is it's important to get consumer follow through on this. In Mexico, CRISPR-Tikal Interactive Network is pulling together a series of climate theaters like planetariums for climate education. There are now three. There will be about 11 by the end of the year. The first of these is the state of Puebla. The state of Puebla has become the first state in the world to move aggressively on black carbon, and I think that's important. We need this kind of action, and we really need to do this. Thank you very much.
The most powerful thing I've learned today is the is a camaraderie that exists in the whole movement towards a meat-free society on planet Earth. That was one of the most wonderful feelings I had today. But apart from that, there was great evidence shown by really, really well-known scientists showing that these intellectual inspirations that I've known about for a long time, whereby I knew that, you know, the eating of meat was destroying the planet. They exposed that to us in very, very clear scientific terms, and some of it was quite shocking.
Thank you for joining us today for Words of Wisdom. Join us again Friday for part two of Leaders Preserving Our Future, Pace and Priorities on Climate Change. And now, please stay tuned to Supreme Master Television for Models of Success, coming up next, right after Noteworthy News. We bid you adieu for now, wishing you much joy in the coming days.
For more details, please visit www.SupremeMasterTV.com/WOW